You're with Rick Munn on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, we've made it into hour three of Locked and Loaded today. It's been a bit of a climate change fest, mixed in with a lot of politics, skullduggery, and shenanigans from around the world. Starting off in Australia, we hopped across to the Czech Republic, speaking about what's going on over there, how the spirit of communism seems to be rising up like a phoenix from the ashes after it was toppled in 1999. It seems to be back in the air again, and it's not just happening in the Czech Republic, it's happening all over the world. Before I invite my next witness to take the stand in this testimony that we're trying to give today against the globalist elite, I want to look at some news that's bubbling to the surface of the cesspit that is known as the United Kingdom and also Ireland. What's going on, you may ask? Well, Dominic Raab. There's a dark horse if ever there was one. Dominic Raab says the court was wrong to block a Rwanda deportation flight. Seven asylum seekers were thrown onto a flight to deport them down to Rwanda to process them as they were seeking asylum in the United Kingdom. What an ungodly waste of money that would have been anyway, to stick seven people on a flight, a chartered flight, to travel down to sub-Saharan Africa to dump them off and to fly back up again. And of course, that came at the taxpayers' expense, or should I say, Rishi Sunak's magic money tree that is printing money hand over fist and ratcheting the price of living and the cost of living up through the roof. And speaking of which, we're being told to brace ourselves here in the United Kingdom as food prices could rise by over 15%. During the summertime. I would be very surprised if it rose by 15%. I expect it'll be well over 20%. So if the government are telling you they're going to be up by 15%, you can bet your ass it's going to be up over 20%. That's the way they work. They're liars, pathological liars, habitual pathological liars, tested and proven over a long period of time. Do not believe a word that comes out of their rancid mouths. That's all I'm going to say on that for now. I'm focusing on the UK because my next guest, despite his odd name, is actually resident in the UK, and we're going to welcome him to the show for the first time on TNT in a minute. Don't go away.
Checking off the boxes.
Established, reputable.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, I am happy to welcome a gentleman, I tell you, to the show for the first time. He's one of the first contacts I think I made when I started out on social media in February last year. Started making little video clips in my car, and he posted a few of them up, and we linked up, and he's a good guy. I'm going to tell you his name. It's Yuri Bezmenov Jr. And this guy was responsible for introducing me to his father, Yuri Bezmenov, the ex-KGB spy who came to the West and told us all about how the Russians did business. Mr. Bezmenov Jr., how the heck are you, sir?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I'm very well. I think we should make it very clear to the audience that I'm not really Yuri Bezmenov's son.
What?
He's an illegitimate or legitimate son, but merely a reincarnation of his, what should we call it, philosophy.
Yeah, I mean, I am happy to talk to you for the first time and see you briefly there. It's always interesting to see people in the flesh, as it were, that, you know, you've had a picture of them in your head. And in your Twitter handle, by the way, which I'll direct people towards, it's at Hotel Lubyanka. Hotel Lubyanka, which, by the way, sounds like one of the destinations these asylum seekers might be heading towards in Rwanda, the Hotel Lubyanka. You can follow him on Twitter, and your profile picture is this Nosferatu type with a big red fez on. I had it in my head that you actually looked like that, so I'm glad to see that you don't. Okay.
Yeah, I'm vaguely human, I'm pleased to say.
But semi-human.
Yeah. I don't even know where that came from. It's a long. I completely lost where the Nosferatu picture came from. Actually, why I ended up selecting that, and the fez was just a joke. Actually, that I organised a meetup in London, and I said I'd wear a fez. So somebody, one of my followers, just photoshopped a fez onto my picture. So that's how it came about.
Tell me this. You had a we'll dig into what's going on in the UK in a minute, but I notice you did have a meetup recently, a big night out, as it were, and you have another one planned, a picnic in the park, which is great. It's where people can meet up physically in person that have been maybe communicating for a while online. How did the first hookup go? Was it a raging success? Were people happy, or was it an unmitigated disaster? Give me the down low.
It was a spectacular success, actually. It exceeded my wildest expectations. When I sort of first started talking about the event, it was really going to be just a social gathering. And the reason it came about, Rick, is so many people that I'd interacted with on Twitter had sort of said how isolated they felt, and, you know, how they'd kind of lost circles of friends and family and just were desperate to meet kind of not necessarily even like-minded people, just people that they could have an open and sort of, you know, honest conversation with without being attacked, you know, and being sort of accused of being a granny murdering psychopath. And and that's kind of what prompted it, really. And then it kind of got a bit out of control, actually, because when I posted the event initially online and said, you know, I'm going to do this event, you know, and I had so many people stepped up and offered to help and get involved. And so it morphed from what was going to be just a bit of a general kind of meet up and a few beers into a mini conference with a dinner, sort of an evening's entertainment and an overnight stay in a hotel. And it was pretty wild, actually. I have to say,
I didn't see any video footage of that, which is probably not a bad thing. You might
that was very deliberate.
Censored heavily.
I think the phrase was "What goes to shenanigan stays at shenanigan," and that's how it's going to stay.
Or what goes in the Hotel Lubyanka stays in the Hotel Lubyanka. It's like the Hotel California. You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. I'm glad. You
know, keeping secrets, I was going to say.
Well, you're certainly good at it, my friend. You're a very shitty individual indeed. I want to talk a little bit about, some of the things. Listen, we're off the same, we're cut from the same cloth in terms of, you know, what we can see is happening. We've been in agreement about that for a while. There are certainly cracks appearing in the narratives, you know, with the whole COVID thing and with the increasing rise in vaccine injuries and people coming forward to tell their stories. There seems to be a disturbing doubling down, both by the medical profession and by government when it comes to, for example, vaccine rollouts. Now, you'd put some posts up. I'm having a bit of a scroll through your Twitter feed here. For example, the Canadian Health Minister, Trudeau's Health Minister, has declared that fully vaccinated now means three injections, saying that two doses simply don't work anymore. But yet, you will have countries in the world that say you must have two doses to be able to do a frontline customer-facing job, like the police or a nurse or a doctor in some parts of the world. Why do people not pick up on the complete disconnect or the lack of, uniformity when it comes to these ludicrous lockdown policies? Are some of these countries just forerunners or experiments for this new world order, or have they just not got their act together?
I think that's a really good question. And the answer, certainly from my point of view, I wish I knew. I find it staggering. I, you know, every single day I kind of read the press and read the news and think, how is it that people are not asking just the basic question, you know, what is going on? This doesn't make any sense. But people don't even seem to be asking that question. You know, it's just, oh, right, yeah, they just accept it blindly. And I almost feel like I think there's a number of overlapping agendas. I've said this all along. I'm not one that is necessarily fully on board with the idea this is all the great, you know, globalist takeover. You know, I think there's a strong element of opportunism. You've got, you know, vested interests that will always seek to exploit, you know, opportunities. You know, the pharmaceutical industry is a genuinely amoral industry, in my view. I think that's pretty clear from the evidence now. And you look at what's been going on with Pfizer and all the vaccine companies. I mean, in any sane world, we would stop all of these programs for at least 12 months until we had some idea of what was going on. And it's just like a juggernaut that's out of control. And I think you've got sort of, you know, generally, it seems to be left sort of leaning governments around the world seem to be the ones in power in most places at the moment. I guess it's a cyclic thing, and partly through sort of placement of, you know, key people and the long march through the institutions that we talk about. And it's a mindset. I mean, I find it interesting that there's been a very clear separation in the last couple of years between sort of, you know, the libertarian kind of pro-market, pro-capitalist sort of, you know, side of, you know, humanity and the sort of the statist, you know, collectivist side of humanity. And that there's this almost unshakable faith that people have, which I find bizarre in the extreme, that the state will look after us. I mean, I don't think that's ever been true in my life, certainly in my lifetime. Uh-huh. So why it would be true now, I don't know. So I don't know. In a long rambling way, I think I've said that I don't really know right there, but I just, the bit that I don't get is the lack of people just asking the question, you know, and just sort of, I mean, I've got that relatives in Canada, for example.
Yeah. And what's their mindset? What's their mindset?
Well, it's interesting because they're unvaccinated. So they're effectively under a form of house arrest in that they managed to escape Canada for a few weeks back in early spring and got across the border into the States for a bit of a break. And I don't quite know how they managed that at the time. And I won't go into too much detail, but, you know, they cannot, they're not allowed to fly. They can't board any public transport in Canada purely on the basis that they've refused to take this, you know, medical procedure that clearly, based on the statistical evidence, offers them almost zero benefits and, you know, actually does present certain known risks. And yet a significant proportion of the Canadian population is quite happy to support that as a policy. I can't fathom it. So
you see, you're looking over at them realistically, and this is what I mean. There's no uniformity with any of this, right? So you're looking over at relatives in Canada, and you're seeing them being prohibited, for example, from getting on a train. Whereas whether we don't have that level of totalitarianism or authoritarianism here in the UK, so you can get on and off a train, and you can travel domestically or internationally without a vaccine, but they can't. So there's a disconnect there. Obviously, they're not following the same science, because it seems to be the science that applies to you is different than the science that applies to them. And by the same token, they're probably looking over at you and are extremely frustrated and wound up to say, well, how come he can travel free? Not directing that at you personally, but it must cause them a lot of frustration and confusion also that they can't have the basic civil liberties that you do, even though, you know, we're both so-called working our way through this great pandemic. And I think that's one of the things that they're doing is they're seeding this confusion and head scratching and lack of, you know, you can't join up the dots with this because, you know, they don't really form any, you know, cognitive picture. And you also mentioned, which was a very good point, is there's a lot of people in this that are opportunists that are certainly lining their pockets and greasing their palms with government subsidies and profiting off the back of all this misery and sadness that people are experiencing. And I just think it's an extremely difficult time to get focused in because they're hitting us from so many angles with so many things, and people I think are just numb right now. I mean, I don't know about you, but I have just had a skinful of all this over the last few years, and it's got to the point now I'm like, okay, I'm bunkering down here, I'm putting my roots down in Northern Ireland, I'm going nowhere, and I'm going to prepare for this and keep myself right. If anyone else wants to listen to what I say, well and good. If they don't, you know, let them fill their boots. That's kind of my mentality right now.
I kind of in the same place, really. I mean, I spent probably the first year of the whole kind of COVID thing, you know, very actively campaigning, you know, quite, I wouldn't say aggressively, certainly assertively, you know, pushing back. And and there came a point probably, about 9 months ago when you think, you know, you're trying to help people that don't want to be helped. And you just have to step away then at that point to say, okay, fine, you know, let's see what happens in the next 2 or 3 years, you know, with the, you know, I mean, I remember back in April 2020, when the first lockdown was announced, I sort of came out publicly and said then that what we're about to witness will be one of the greatest upward transfer of wealth in man, you know, living history. And that's pretty much exactly what's happened. And it was blindingly obvious to me at the time when you think, you know, they basically, you know, closed down pretty much every SME that wasn't either, you know, supplying takeaway food or, you know, essential supplies, you know, the hospitality sector and lots of small businesses. But, you know, people like Amazon and all the online businesses, you know, exploded in terms of growth. And it was so blindingly obvious early on what was going on. And yet, you know, I think that the people that kind of enjoyed the novelty, I think, of, you know, not going to work but still getting paid, you know, became quite accustomed to it. And it's like being in a, I don't know, in a car, isn't it, or something, where you're having a lovely trip in a car heading towards a cliff and you're enjoying the trip so much, nobody wants to look out the window. And eventually, you know, you hit catastrophe. And, you know, that's what we're starting to see now. And
it is. Do you not find habit forming, right? I developed some good habits during the lockdowns. I also developed some bad habits during the lockdowns. And when you develop a habit is very difficult to break. And they say it takes between 30 and 60 days to develop a habit, good or bad. When that's people got into the habit of not having to get public transport, the habit of not doing a daily commute, the habit of not sitting in maybe an office with people that they didn't particularly like and get on with, and that extended past the 3 weeks to flatten the curve to 3 months, and then some people were off for 18 months on furlough. And by heavens, my friend, what kind of a habit? That would have been almost like a learned behavior at that point. Is like, I don't have to get up in the morning, I don't have to commute, I don't have to sit in an office, and I don't have to fight my way home for 6 o'clock every night, wrecked and burnt out and frazzled. I've been used to doing it at home. Yeah. And unfortunately, I think a lot of people have learned a lot of behaviors over the last 18 months or the last 2 years, some of which are not particularly good. And it's going to be hell trying to unravel those learned behaviors.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a big sort of swing at the moment of businesses. I know quite a few businesses locally that have you know, lived with working from home and remote working for sort of 18 months, 2 years. And they're now actively telling their employees, you know, to get back in the office. And they're finding that actually there's a small proportion, probably 20% of the workforce that actually are almost refusing to come back to work. Uh-huh. And, you know, there's going to be a bit of a shakeout in the next few months, I think. I mean, the company I work for, I mean, I work for a sort of an arm's length government agency, effectively. Mm-hmm. So I work in the public sector, and you know, we've been working from home for 2 years now, and we'll be going through an office move fairly soon and shrinking our office footprint by about 70%. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll only have enough desks in the office to accommodate about a third of the workforce. So effectively we've accepted as an organization, and in terms of what we do, actually, we don't really need an office. So I think that, you know, it makes perfect sense for us. But, you know, we've accepted that actually we'll be remote working, you know, for the foreseeable future, you know, permanently.
I have a similar story. What we're going to do is actually, because I come from before I get into this business that I'm doing now, I worked for 11 years as part of a large government social housing provider in Belfast. And I have a similar, I want to compare stories almost because you seem to have went through the same experiences I did since March 2020 up until certainly the point that we're at now. But we're going to take a real quick break. We're going to listen to some lovely adverts. And when we come back, we're going to talk working from home, because I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that may actually be working from home right now listening to this and may actually be filled with a thought of dread about being dragged kicking and screaming back into the office place, as I know I was. So we're going to touch on that when we come back. I'm speaking to Yuri Bezmenov Jr. I'm Rick Munn Sr. And this is Locked and Loaded on TNT Radio. Don't go away.
John Matlin on TNT Radio.
How does it even get to this point where anyone can look at this and say it's okay or normal? It's outright collusion against the process of a fair election. You have this mega entity with Meta, or Facebook as it was called at that point, and they're dumping in a super large amount of money into the election. There's election officials disregarding law. And these same election officials are going around and they're very anti-Trump in most cases, and they're saying it out loud. And then when they get caught with any type of illegal process, they're getting funds from Zuckerberg. So when do we call it any more obvious than this, that there is an effort in concert to disenfranchise voters?
Well, I think that's right.
John Matlin on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Not completing high school is more of a social thing than it was an academic thing. Even though all these years have passed, I still had that longing to have my diploma.
At age 30, Carissa finished her high school diploma.
If you're even considering getting your high school diploma, you can do it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
This is today's News Talk and the Voice of Freedom, TNT Radio.
Okay, we're talking working from home specifically in the UK. I have experienced it. My guest has experienced it, is currently experiencing it. And was it not a real eye-opener for you just about how completely pointless the daily commute and the exorbitant office fees and rental fees that our companies were paying out to just simply house us in our little cubicles was? Did that not shine a light on that for you, if nothing else, over the last 2 years, Mr. Bezmenov?
Well, it's interesting. I most of my career I spent in industry, so from a sort of manufacturing background. So, you know, you can't do that from home. You have to be there. Mm-hmm. And but what I also experienced in that there was this huge presenteeism sort of agenda where, you know, there was an obsession with, you know, being in the workplace, irrespective of what work you were doing. So, you know, my sort of role was a technical role. So partly shop floor based and partly sort of office based. And, you know, depending on what work you were doing, if I was designing a new production line or something, you know, I could be spending the whole week in the office. And actually, it would have been quite useful from time to time to have some time out of the office just to concentrate, because you tend to get interrupted, you know, regularly during the day with production problems and things. So, you know, it's very disruptive in terms of productivity and that. But the idea, if I'd have said to my sort of director at the time, you know, I've had, you know, I'm going to work from home this week to do this, he'd have looked at me as though I was mad. He'd have said, "Yeah, what are you talking about? That'd be ridiculous, you know." And yet within the space of a matter of weeks, we flipped that completely. And suddenly everything was possible. I mean, I remember years ago, my kids were young, having a massive argument with my director at the time when I asked for some flexibility to come in late a couple of days a week to drop the kids off at nursery. And we were literally talking about coming in an hour late, twice, 2 days a week. And even though I was probably working a 50, 60 hour week on a regular basis, and it was a major drama. And I remember thinking at the time, this is absolutely nuts. You know, we're having an argument about an hour when I'm effectively giving the company a minimum of 10 hours a week, effectively of free time. And and yet in the space of, you know, a matter of 2 or 3 weeks. And I do find it interesting. The one thing I did question at the time was how suddenly, I mean, I can remember back in, it would have been in the early sort of 2000s, I worked for a big multinational at the time, and we were experimenting with video conferencing at the time. And it was actually pretty good. We had sort of rooms set up with video cameras and things. And we were doing video conferencing with our offices out in the States, and it all worked reasonably well. And almost nothing happened then for nearly 20 years, it seemed to me, until suddenly when COVID came in, we suddenly had all these software solutions. I mean, people had been using Skype for a few years, which I think universally people thought was pretty crap. And then suddenly we had Microsoft Teams, you know, Zoom, WebEx, all these things suddenly appeared almost overnight to facilitate home working almost instantaneously. And
yeah, it's strange, isn't it?
You know, however naive you are, it's kind of hard to feel that that was a, all of that was a coincidence, you know, because the idea that, I mean, one of the things I said to somebody recently, you know, lockdowns and COVID couldn't have happened in 2015. You know, the government would have said, we want to send everybody home for, you know, 6 weeks. We're going to shut the economy, you know, but not just the bits that, of the economy that need to physically be open. We're going to basically send every government office home. We're going to send, you know, every, I don't know, accountancy
close
business,
the GPs.
Marketing.
Close the GPs, GPs as well. Who would have thought that?
And it would have, you know, the country would have collapsed overnight virtually. And I think, again, back to the point I made about opportunism, I think, so I'm absolutely convinced people must have looked at the potential for this whole kind of lockdown thing and said, actually, we've got the technology now to make it work, so let's do it.
And they did. And they did. And I mean, like my own, I'm thinking about people, my last day in work technically in the office, it's a day I'll never forget. I think it was the 20th of March, 2020. That was when I was told you have to take a laptop, go home and, you know, you can work from home. And everybody was perplexed going, how is this even going to be possible? You know, we all work together in a team and we're all in the same place, but we found out pretty quick that it's completely doable. And there's one guy I used to work with who I'm friendly with. He was quite senior in the organization, and he had a long commute every day to travel into Belfast to do his work, and he had been trying to work one day per week in a closer office, not even from home, but in a closer office to home, that he didn't have to make that big commute. And the fighting and carrying on that went on to take a day a week to move a little bit closer to home to still come into an office was unreal. But then on the 20th of March, guess what? He was told, go home, don't come back, use your computer. And guess what? 2 years and what, 4 months later, he's still there. He's still working from home just like that for 2.5 years. And guess what? The business hasn't collapsed. Nothing hasn't been not done. Where I worked, the area that I worked in, my productivity went up when I was working from home. And I didn't mind doing a little bit of extra in the evenings to get the work done, because I'm like, I don't have to sit on a train. I don't have to go in and out of that office. I don't have to sit in a sterile, fusty environment under artificial light with the windows closed and, you know, all that sort of business. It showed me that it was completely unnecessary. And, you know, they tried to get me back twice, last August and again in September or October. And boy, did I kick and scream and wail and put up the fight of my life to remain at home. And I succeeded. But sadly, had I still been there right now, I would have been back into the office as per now and not a particularly happy, productive bunny. So yeah, I dodged a bullet with that one, so I did.
Yeah, I think it's you know, there's no doubt that for most people, I would say that has been a benefit, you know, that most people would not want to lose. You know, I probably work from home two and a half days a week on average. And, you know, just small things, like if you've got, I had a gas boiler service done the other day, and like I'd have had to take in a half a day as it happened. I just answered the door. The guy came in, did what he needed to do and left an hour later. And without any issues at all. And and the big one as well, and I think particularly now with fuel costs, I mean, the commuting thing is absolutely going to be a key driver, because, I mean, years back, I used to commute up into London for a bit. And I mean, I'm talking 20 odd years ago. And the train fares then were like $4,000 a year, I think, something crazy. And I can't imagine what they are. It must be 10 grand a year now, that same ticket.
And to suffer twice a day, and that's what it is, suffering on the commute. You know, you're wedged in with other people, you're squashed in like sardines. It's a long journey, and even before you get to your destination, you're in bad form. Then you've got to trudge along the platform with, you know, you really get the feeling of being in the rat race. I don't know about you, but I was conscious of being a rat in the race in the mornings and I got off on the platform and we all scuttled like rats through the, and then we all dispersed down little avenues and went to our own little offices. You know, it really does drive that point home, doesn't
it? Your point about productivity, I think, is an important one as well, Rick. Mm-hmm. I think I read a book a few years ago by a guy, Tim something, called The 4-Hour Working Week. Mm-hmm. And his premise was that he'd done a lot of research looking at, you know, what people achieve in the office and how much work they do. And also, you know, the value that you create. So, you know, as an individual, you know, you get paid a salary. So the value that you have to create on behalf of the company for them to afford to be able to pay you, run their premises and make a profit, kind of gives you an indication of what the true value is of the work that you're doing. And he basically boiled it down by this process of analysis to say that actually you're creating sufficient value in 4 hours a week to sustain yourself. And that was his whole premise. And so, I'm going to be a bit provocative here because luckily I'm anonymous because I probably wouldn't want to admit this in public, but lots of people I know working from home talk about, you know, doing a bit more, you know, working extra hours and, you know, because they're not traveling and out. And I frankly think that's bullshit.
Yeah, I agree.
I think most people are doing less hours, but what they're doing is the hours they're doing are actually producing, you know, good quality work. And therefore, you know, they're producing
Let me confess, you know, whenever I said I was more productive at home, you know, I didn't say it was work. Well, I did. I lied a little bit, said it was working a little bit extra. I wasn't at all. I was not distracted. Right. And I didn't have to go to pointless meetings, you know, where people sit around a table and they look at a projector, or an overhead, you know, screen from a computer with facts and figures on it and talk about housekeeping rules and what might be happening in a year and personnel changes that takes up 2 hours a day. And then faffing around, going to the photocopier and back and sitting on the toilet while you're checking on your Facebook posts. By the time you siphon all that crap out, my friend, you know, you could realistically do an
you might be oversharing
in about 2 hours. Of course, I didn't partake in any of that business. I don't have Facebook,
obviously,
I wouldn't even condone that. But I'm sure there are people out there that would have done it. Of course, not me. But listen, that's you extrapolate that across the UK workforce, mate, and you look it up, all those hours of wasted time. And as you say, 4 hour. I'd say, listen, let's be honest. If we condensed it all down in an office environment, if people actually worked, I remember Billy Connolly used to do a skit where he said about people working from 9 to 5. He says, people don't work from 9 to 5. No one comes into an office at 9 and jumps straight onto their computer and starts to work. He says, you go to the kitchen, you make a cup of tea, you talk to your friends about what's on the TV, you walk back to your desk, you drink your cup of tea. Before you know it, it's 10 o'clock and then it's time for tea break. So you go back to the kitchen, you get another cup of tea, and then it's lunchtime and then it's home time. So yeah, let's be under no illusions here. No one does a full 9 to 5 day. It's more like 2 to 3, probably. You squeeze everything in and then you scuttle off back home again on the train. I mean, isn't that right?
And I think that's one of the reasons, my personal take on it, is that's why, you know, there's been so little pushback on lockdowns and restrictions and everything, because all the decision makers, you know, in businesses and mm-hmm. you know, local government and central government are all enjoying the same benefits. The people that aren't enjoying those benefits, and I've, you know, spent most of my career in that sort of field, is people working on production lines, you know, people in supermarkets, people in warehouses that are doing all the actual physical work, you know, because you can't do it from home. So, you know, they'd love the opportunity to you know, work 4 hours a day, I'm sure. And I mean, but, you know, they don't get a vote, essentially. And so,
no, they can't. I mean, I remember when this was brought in, there was a lot of crying and weeping and gnashing of teeth from people. For example, train drivers, bus drivers, people working in supermarkets and warehouses. They were saying, well, it's not fair. It's not fair that they can work from home and we just can't work from home. But to be honest, and I'm not having a go at anyone, that's tough. That's the work that you just happen to be in. And it's just not physically possible for you to work from home. Yeah. The biggest eye opener I got, mate, was the GP situation. I mean, there's a health center, in inverted commas, a health center. Someone put a skull and crossbones flag up outside it recently, which I thought was very fitting. But anyway, it's a health center, the 3-4 stories high, full of doctors, nurses' practices, blood bank, etc., etc. That closed for 2 years. Now, prior to it closing, at any given day, if you wanted an emergency appointment, you would go into that place and they would be queued. All the reception rooms were taken up with seats. There were people standing in a line in the corridor waiting to get round to see the doctor. And the doctor was always late. And there was just hordes upon hordes of old people and sick people and infirm people sitting waiting to be seen. And you would have thought to yourself, it's not possible for this place for my hometown to function without this doctor's practice. But then the doors closed in March 2020. And guess what? I don't know what the hell happened to all those sick people and all those grannies and grandas and all those people that wanted their prescriptions. But mate, the place was like a ghost town. You know, what's going on with the medical? Were they bluffers as well? Were these doctors simply bluffers? You know, I joke about them. They sit and they Google. You go into the doctor and you say, I'm sick. The first thing they'll ask you is, well, what do you think's wrong with you? And to be frank, you've probably Googled your symptoms and say, well, I think it could be sciatica or I think it could be repetitive strain injury. And they'll probably look at you and Google it and say, yep, you're right, and give you a prescription and kick you out. You know, does it not highlight also the fact that the whole medical establishment, especially at GP levels, just a production line, they're just there ticking boxes and doling out prescriptions to make their quotas.
I have a little bit of sympathy with GPs, because I think, I mean, you know, certainly over my lifetime, I mean, I remember as kids, you know, it was you'd only go to the doctor if you were close to death, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, something was, you know, you were either, you know, bleeding or oozing some bodily fluid from some revolting orifice or something.
Let's not go there.
You know, the number of things that, you know, we had sort of, you know, home try, and I can remember, you know, I'm one of sort of several kids, and, you know, it was quite normal for your siblings to be quite ill, you know, and we had all these kind of home contraptions that my mother used to wheel out. And, you know, occasionally, if it was really serious, you might go to the doctors. But the thing I find now, and I know there's been a huge push with like the 101 number and the pharmacies to take on more, but, you know, people kind of get a bit of a twinge somewhere or they get a runny nose and they want to go to the doctors and get some antibiotics. I was working with a guy and I was genuinely shocked about 3-4 years ago, a young guy I was in the office with, and he came in one day. He said, I don't feel great. I've got a bit of a sore throat. And so he rang his doctor to try to get an appointment to see the doctor with a sore throat. And this is a guy who's like a fit 25-year-old. And I said to him, what are you doing? You know, you've got a sore throat. Like, take some, you know, Strepsils and man up. And so he basically got a doctor's appointment, came out with a prescription for antibiotics. You know, so he's taken, you know, an appointment from somebody that might have actually been sort of, you know, ill that needed some treatment. And I remember at the time thinking, like, if I was a GP, I'd be thinking, sod this for a laugh.
It seems to be there's a rise in people, especially with, you know, when the NHS rolled out their website to tell people what the symptoms of COVID were. For example, you know, running last summer, it was a runny nose and, you know, running eyes. You know, that's hay fever by anybody else's description. Yeah. You know, you take an antihistamine, one a day for about a week, and you keep the windows closed at night and you should be okay. But as a result of that, people were told, okay, you need to self-isolate for 14 days, tell all your friends and family, nobody can go out, you stay away from work, you work from home no matter what. And it just seemed to perpetuate this, not hypochondria, but people were looking They wanted to be diagnosed with COVID, not a ventilator down their throat or a dose of midazolam at the expense of Matt Hancock, yeah, but they certainly wanted to have that diagnosis because they knew it meant they would have 2 weeks off and they weren't actually sick, even if they could be asymptomatic, if you could believe that. And it was just a license to sit at home and chill out, especially when the weather was good. So, yeah, I get where you're coming from. It's a strange old setup in the NHS at the minute. We're going to take one more quick break, and when we come back, maybe we'll look at the health service in a little bit more detail. There was a few other things we wanted to talk about. Well, a lot of things, but time just flies, don't you think, when you're chewing the fat on live radio. This is TNT. We shall be back in 2 minutes after these ads. Don't go away.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
Adam Laxalt had a resounding win in the 14th of June Nevada Senate Republican primary, receiving 56% of the vote. In the corresponding Democratic primary, incumbent Representative Catherine Cortez Masto had an easy win, receiving 90% of the vote. But in the November midterm election, Cortez Masto faces a much more difficult challenge against Laxalt. She is considered one of the most vulnerable Senate Democrats, and Laxalt will likely be one of several GOP challenges to topple incumbent Democrats. Laxalt had many endorsements, including from Donald Trump, Senator Ted Cruz, Governor Ron DeSantis, and General Mike Flynn. Laxalt has fought hard against vaccine and mask mandates, and as early as April 2020, he opposed forced COVID shutdowns. He has consistently challenged the 2020 presidential election result and will be a good replacement for Cortez Masto. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
What if you were wearing something sexy? What if you were drinking? What if you made the first move? No matter what, sexual assault is never your fault. Support is available 24/7 through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit RAIN.org. That's RAINN.org. This is Christina Ricci with RAIN, reminding you it's never your fault.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Mainstream media censors, smears, and intimidates those telling the truth.
We mandate that the truth be told.
Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Okay, I'm sad, a little bit sad. I'm coming up to the end of the show today. Excuse me, my throat's a little bit croaky. Need some more honey, and some more fresh air, and a little bit more water down the old neck to keep me up and running. It's not COVID. It's not monkeypox. It's just a little bit of stress and strain in my old throat. The old whistle needs to be wet. I'm wrapping it up here with Mr. Bezmenov Jr., which is his screen name. He's the illegitimate love child of Yuri Bezmenov Sr. and probably Princess Anne, I'm guessing. I don't know for sure, or some other member of the royal family. Yeah, that's up for debate. We're talking a lot of things. Yeah, I'm close. We're talking a lot of things. We're just chewing the fat from one human being to another, which is not a crime, despite what the government might have told you recently. There seems to be, I'm seeing a lot of people are forming groups and being quite vocal at the moment. Doctors groups, some lawyer groups, and also many, many vaccine injured people are starting to come together. Now, sadly, I'll just say this. Yesterday, I put something up on Twitter. There's a gentleman up in Scotland, one of many, Alex Mitchell, who lost a leg after the AstraZeneca vaccine. I've had him on the show, interviewed him. He's been through a hell of a time. And a group of people are raising up their voices. Let's talk about it. They've been trying to raise awareness on Twitter. An MP, by the way, I don't know if you know this or not, but yesterday an MP called John Mason from the Scottish Party, I think Nicola Sturgeon's party. His handle, by the way, on Twitter is at John Mason MSP. He actually started mocking the vaccine injured on a post that he put up. And let me quote, he talked about having had three jags. He's certainly fine and well. He'll take the fourth one. Clearly, they have saved many lives. I'm extremely grateful. Someone replied, said, well, you politicians will have to deal with injuries now. Good luck. Many people warned you. You didn't listen. And then he laughed and he said, I'm more than happy if someone takes us to court. But so far they haven't. I wonder why not, because they have a weak case. LOL. This is coming from a member of the Scottish Parliament called John Mason, openly, actively mocking the people that have been injured or maybe lost a loved one or a relative as a result of these vaccines. Do you think deep down, I mean, Nick, I have no doubt in my mind, Johnson is having a good old laugh, you know, when he thinks about how he gets fined for Partygate, what, 50 quid, and there's people still sitting with £5,000 or £10,000 fines hanging over their heads for protesting in the streets against what his party was doing. Is there not a real inversion? And is this something to troll us and piss us right off because we are awake to what's happening, or am I just overreading the situation?
The thing I've learned in the last 2 years is that, I mean, I always had a low opinion of, you know, politicians, frankly, but I'm absolutely certain now that part of the selection criteria is you have to be a qualified sociopath, because the, you know, some of the responses that you see, it's extraordinary that, I mean, at some point they must have sort of advisors and the press office would, you'd think they'd rein it in. So the conclusion you have to come to is that these things are kind of not necessarily supported, but they're certainly condoned and they get tacit support, because otherwise, you know, they'd have a rap on the knuckles. And I mean, there's the one that I remember was who's the Conservative MP, the ex-military guy. He was Minister for Veterans at one point. God, I can't. Johnny Mercer. Yeah, Johnny Mercer.
Yes, Johnny Mercer.
Yeah. Some of the stuff he put on Twitter when there was, you know, conversations about vaccine injuries, and was just like shocking, absolutely shocking, you know, using sort of, you know, profanity to like talk to a member of the public who's just asking a perfectly valid question about vaccine injuries. And I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. You made a comment there just in your sort of intro, Rick, where this guy had said, you know, the vaccine has saved many lives. And I think that's just an act of faith, actually. I don't think there's any credible evidence to support that.
There's none.
You know, it's
how can
it's
you prove that, by the way? How can you prove it? How can you prove it?
I know.
If I said to you today, okay, I'm going to give you a glass of water every day, okay, and if you drink it, it's going to reduce your chances of getting COVID. All right. And let's say you drink it for a year and you don't get COVID. You can't then say it was the water that saved me. Maybe you just didn't get it, or your immune system was simply strong enough. There's no way to quantify this at all. It's pie in the sky. There's no quantifiable evidence out there.
And I mean, for me, the empirical evidence on the other side is that, I mean, I now associate and you know hundreds of people who are unvaccinated, you know, have not had any vaccinations whatsoever, you know, let alone boosters and fourth boosters and God knows what else. And out of, I don't know, however many people that would be, 300 people, let's say, I know of one of those that was hospitalized and was quite poorly for a few days. You know, if you take in the same period, I've actually lost two friends have passed away from different things, one from cancer, one had a brain hemorrhage in that same period. So the idea that a vaccine saved lives is, you know, frankly, for the birds, I think, in the, you know, and it's not because that cohort of people are exceptionally fit and healthy, you know, health freaks, that you know, they're a completely normal spectrum of the population in terms of, you know, age, demographics, you know, health habits. You know, quite a few are, you know, heavy smokers, you know, a couple of them are asthmatics, for example. So you're thinking, you know, on the basis of the evidence that's being presented to us by the sort of, you know, the health bodies and the pharmaceutical companies, you would think that two or three of those people would have died of COVID, and 20 or 30 of us would have been seriously ill, potentially hospitalized. So, I suppose if you go back to day one, I still remember Chris Whitty's original press briefing on COVID back in March 2020, when he said, you know, most people will get a mild illness. Some may be more ill. A few will get hospitalized, and sadly, you know, one or two may die, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And that kind of has been lost in time, really. And from then on, where COVID was effectively, and even Chris Whitty himself effectively was saying at the time, it's a nasty version of flu, basically, in terms of mortality. The world then completely lost its shit. And that's the bit where I think there was clearly some, you know, major agenda driving going on from people like the, you know, Fauci and Gates and the pharmaceutical industry, because I mean, the pharmaceutical, I was reading an article two or three years ago about the pharmaceutical industry, and the, one of the phrases that was used in relation to the pharmaceutical industry was the razor blade business model. And that's the thing with, you know, vaccine. If you look at the vaccine programs, it's a cash cow. You know, they've got, you know, a guaranteed income on a rolling annual basis by producing, you know, multitude of vaccines. So they've got a consistent underlying sort of income stream, you know, which is the same as like the, you know, there's some great, if you ever want to look at a great case study in marketing, look at what Gillette did back in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, when razor blades were becoming a commodity product, basically. And Gillette said, we can't compete in that market. So they converted razor blades into a lifestyle product. And then, you know, spent billions of dollars on advertising and, you know, the best a man can get and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now, like, you know, I don't know what the latest is, Gillette Quantum Turbo 5 or something. They're about £6 each. You know, and I shave, like, I use a blade a week. You know, I've got quite a sort of heavy beard. So, you know, it's kind of become like a significant cost to me just to have a shave every week. And the pharmaceutical industry, I think, was always envious of that business model, and they've absolutely cracked it now. I mean, I was looking at something the other day. It was absolutely horrifying. The vaccine schedule for an American child, they have 70, apparently, and I've not verified this, but what was being quoted was they get 72 shots by the time they're 15.
72.
And you just think, you know, every one of those is obviously paid for. You know, every one of those is either paid for by, I mean, in America, I presume you have to pay from yourselves, I assume. So, you know, and that's every one of those is a revenue, you know, point for the pharmaceutical industry. And you think, you know, in a population of, you know, there's probably 100 million kids in America, 72 times. Now you're talking astronomical numbers.
Astronomical, yeah. Isn't it? The NHS one, just on the subject, I checked out the NHS's vaccination. If you just go on to nhs.gov.uk, just put child vaccination, from the age of 8 weeks to 16 weeks. So you're talking from what, 2 months to 4 months. So a 2-month-old child to 4-month-old child gets eight injections before they're 16 weeks old. Eight injections, so that's 4 in each arm, one of which is a 6-in-1 vaccine. What the hell that is exactly, I don't know, but one of those 8 injections is actually a mixture of 6 other products combined together in one shot. Yeah. So by the time a child is, what, 4 months old, they've already had 8 needles inserted into their bodies and injected with a lot of substances that I'm pretty sure now are not necessarily needed for that child to make it to adulthood.
I got approached by the radio, by a local radio a few weeks ago, and the opening line, the researcher who rang me up was, because through some of the contact I'd had, they say, is that right? You're an anti-vaxxer. And I said, no. I said, although having said that, I said, I never used to be, but having now done some research, I'm much closer to being an anti-vaxxer than I used to be.
I'd be the same, because anyway. I've had lots of jabs for going away overseas, and I mean it was like a pincushion from 2007 until 2012. My God, man, I've had so many jabs, but I went in blindly. I went in and took the travel nurse at her word. I didn't get any informed consent, and I just assumed that everything was needed. Number one, it was necessary, and number two, that it was safe. I'll tell you something. Going back again, if I had to do it all again, or I had to go away from this point forward, I would be doing a hell of a lot of due diligence in my own personal research before I just simply nodded and agreed with whatever suite of products was set in front of me. And then, of course, the scare tactics is like, well, you don't want to be stuck out in Kenya if you get diphtheria, and you don't want to be coming back with hepatitis B or tuberculosis or meningococcal meningitis strain B. Yeah, I don't want to be, but the chances of me actually getting that stuff out there are actually infinitesimally small. And I base that on the fact that I traveled extensively for 11 years, and I was in field clinics, and I was in hospitals, in cities, and in rural areas. And for example, I said, have you guys ever treated rabies here? No. Never seen a case ever. What, never? No, right. Never. And I went through Tanzania, I went through Kenya, I went through Uganda. Never seen a case ever in 11 years. And these people have been practicing in the bush for like 20, 30 years. So when I came back to the travel nurse and she said, you need your rabies course. I'm like, no, I'm not having it. Oh, you're crazy. If you get rabies out there, you're going to die. I said, that may be true, but I've yet to meet or speak with anyone that's ever had it or has known anyone that had it. And I'm afraid I'm not prepared to roll up my sleeves for another 3 shots of that because, quite frankly, I don't need it. And she just looked at me as if it was a 2-headed monster, to be quite frank.
Yeah, I know.
Molello, crazy, you know. But anyway, we're actually, believe it or not, the hours run away with us. It's been really good to talk with you, and I've really enjoyed having you on the show, and hopefully it hasn't been too stressful an experience for yourself. And I would like to think, maybe if the planets align for us again, Mr. Bizmenov Jr., that we'll get you back on TNT Radio and we can dig into something else that's going on currently in the UK. But for now, thank you. I appreciate it. Hope it's been a nice experience for you. And you listeners, you're welcome. This is TNT Radio. I'm Rick Munn. That was Yuri Bizmenov Jr. And there's more magic happening after the news with, I believe, none other than Mr. Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire. He's got his own show here too. Don't go away. The magic never ends on TNT Radio. See you tomorrow.